incipient black hole. And hopefully the title will become clearer after the seminar. Let me just give you the citation before I begin. This work was done with Lawrence Krauss and Dejan Stojkovic, and then a paper with Dejan, and then one by myself. And the archive numbers are 6. So the aim is to study gravitational collapse. Including quantum effects. And this is an old problem. And I got into it because of the stuff of producing black holes in LHC. So the motivation for me was black hole in LHC. They could also be in the ultra high energy cosmic rays, or they could be in astrophysics or cosmology. So it's So this kind of project has of course lots of applications. So clearly in LHC, what you're talking about is particles coming in and colliding at very high energies, and then the idea is, can you pack enough energy in a certain region so that it becomes a black hole? If these are charged, let's say positive, positive, then of course they will emit electromagnetically, and you have to worry about the energy losses as these particles are coming together. So I will of course not consider charged particles, I will consider neutral particles, but what I will see is that there's radiation nonetheless, and you have to worry about the energy losses as this thing collapses.
It's very, very small. It supplies an enormous energy.
Yes, I mean, so the people talking about black holes in LHC talk about them in the context of a higher dimensional theories, where the Planck scale is smaller, TeV or something. Yes, yes. But for me, that distinction doesn't really matter. I mean, I'm just considering, can you bring things into their own choice? Okay. All right. So, so of course, this problem is complicated. And I want to set up a simpler system, which I might be able to deal with. And so the system I will look at is a spherical wall or membrane. So there won't be any structure to this, to the shell that's collapsing. In addition, I have the metric. And I will include another scalar field. So I will restrict myself to spherical symmetry. So you have a spherical wall or a membrane and a spherical metric. So clearly you won't have radiation in the metric, in gravitons. So for radiation, I include an extra scalar field. So this is the system. And then the question is, how do you describe the system? So the approach I will use is the functional Schrodinger equation. And you all know that this is just some Hamiltonian acting on some wave function is I d psi by dt. And here, psi should be actually a function O, but it should depend on the position of the wall, the metric, the scalar field, and time. So it's rather complicated. Because it's complicated, I want to simplify life yet further. So I take a spherical shell, which means that that x mu, which is the position of the shell, is just given by one radial function of time. Okay? And the mass per unit area of the shell will be denoted by sigma. All right, so this was the spherical shell. Then the question is, what do you do with the metric? And here I go to the result by Ipsa-Sikivi. If you have a spherical shell, then outside the metric is Schwarzschild, inside it is flat, and so then you can write down the metric ds squared is minus 1 minus rs by r dt squared plus 1 minus rs by r dr squared plus r squared d omega squared. And this is valid for little r larger than r of t. And inside it is minus t capital T squared plus dr squared plus r squared d omega squared. This is for r less than r of t. And you need to match these two coordinates. And well, maybe I'll do that here. So you do it in the proper time of the wall, dt by d tau is 1 plus dr by d tau whole squared to the half, and d little t by d tau is 1 over b plus dr by d tau whole squared to the half, where this function b is 1 minus rs by capital R. So I just define this. And this capital B will come up quite frequently, so I just want you to keep in mind that it is 1 minus the Schwarzschild radius by this wall radius. This is not little r, but it's capital. Okay, so the metric for a spherical domain wall having size r of t is known. Tau is the proper time for the wall.
Yes.
You have some Israel junction conditions and you match the metrics across. It's a standard procedure. Yeah. All right. So I should save this. Sorry? At this, is there any function? No. Not yet. Eventually, when I do a semi-classical analysis, I will have to take it to be some function, and I will take it to be the solution, the classical solution. But we'll get to that later. Sorry. R of t is some function. Yeah. Okay, so to remember that the functional Schrodinger equation requires an H, and so we have to start coming up with a Hamiltonian. And so the Hamiltonian of the wall, so I will write down in an intuit.
Are you assuming no extrinsic curvatures at the boundary
that you're going to
match them?
You mean at the, yeah. At the wall?
Sorry. Yeah, at the wall, sorry.
So these are the conditions that come up.
Well,
so that relates capital T to little t.
Yeah, if you haven't said anything about extrinsic curvature, you could have stress energy in the wall, which would get a different thing than if you don't have. So
right, so the stress energy of the wall is known. It's for a domain wall, or whatever it is. So it's for a flat domain wall, it would be sigma 0, 0 minus.
You're
going to
take different extrinsic curvatures and match them across.
Yes, so I haven't done this. I'm relying on Ibsen's EV.
Okay, all right. But that's in there.
Yes, that's in there. No.
It's the stress energy of the wall, basically.
So sigma doesn't really.
But if you're going to quantize, I guess, you know, what are you going to quantize that wall itself? Well, go ahead.
Okay. So the Hamiltonian here is given by a mass, that there's a Lorentz factor, and then there's a gravitational self energy. So I can write it like this, where M tilde is this surface energy times 4 pi r squared, and r sub capital T stands for dr by dt. Now, if I write this, actually all this is going to become physically quite obvious in a minute, but let me take two limits. One, let me first convert t to little time t, and also take the b going to zero limit, or rather the small b limit, where r is close to rs. In that case, this Hamiltonian becomes something which is quite recognizable. So it becomes something like square root of momentum squared plus a mass squared, and except that mu here is a renormalized mass, just sigma 1 minus 2 pi g sigma rs. But even this is too complicated for me. In the limit as b goes to 0, this actually reduces to minus b. This term drops out. Yeah. So I'm not interested in what goes on when the wall is large and far away from a black hole. I don't care. So, to derive this Hamiltonian, I look at the Ipsos-Sikivi dynamics and make sure that this Hamiltonian is conserved and has the same dynamics. I actually have not found a satisfactory way to derive it from the action by plugging in the ansatz and stuff like that. And I'm told that there is that it might be because there is this term, which is a self energy, which is somewhat depends on the long range behavior. So it has an m tilde squared, which is a sigma squared self gravity correction, and that I'm told gives problems in deriving the Hamiltonian. It has the same classical equation. And indeed, this exact form really doesn't matter very much. Because in the end, what you have is that this is the Hamiltonian for an ultra-relativistic particle. No, this is just the domain wall right now. It's only the domain wall. Only the domain wall. And you know when things sort of are falling into the black hole, they become ultra-relativistic. So it's and there's this gravitational correction, which is the B part. And momentum, you can also write in terms of R and R dot, if you wish. Okay, so here is the wall Hamiltonian, and now. Okay, so the minus is for a collapsing wall, and so the minus is for a collapsing wall. So this is. So yes. Yes, pi will be so, but this one has a b in front of it. Yes, but pi diverges. You have to work. No. So you have to. Right. So when you look at the solution, you find that this is diverging as one over b, and this is actually going to a constant. So let's see. I can actually tell you exactly how R dot behaves. R dot. Something like B 1 minus half B R to the 4 divided by a constant. So yeah, we've sort of worked that out. And that's looking good. Okay, so this is the wall, and now let's come to the scalar field. Oops, no need to. So the scalar field action, we all know, is just going to be integral d4x. Root minus g half g mu nu d mu phi d mu phi. And I'm again going to restrict the spherical symmetry so phi is a function of r and t. I could include angular coordinates, it won't make any difference. But let's just. And I expand it in certain modes. And now I plug this back in, I have the metric, and I find that S of phi goes to integral dt minus 1 over 2b. B is the, again, 1 minus r is pi r. And here you have k dot k, the matrix, mkk prime. AK prime dot plus half AK, a matrix NKK prime, AK prime. So it's quadratic, so you have quadratics in A's. Yeah. But the important point is that this matrix, MKK prime, is equal to 4 pi. Integral 0 to rs dr, r squared fkr, fk prime r. It's some integral over these basis functions. And similarly, nkk prime is some integral. But the important point is that these are independent of R of t. Okay? So as you approach the black hole, b goes to zero, the scalar field action reduces to something like this. And so now you have these matrices that are symmetric in K and K prime, and you can use the principal axis transformation. So at the for the time being, they are just some functions, some basis, complete basis of functions. And now I'm basically going and finding the eigenmodes. Okay?
Well,
for the wall that's collapsing. Yeah? So this is the principal axis transformation. And which means that I can diagonalize M and N, which means that I can just look at one eigenmode, right? So I have found the eigenmodes, and let me call that one eigenmode B of t. Then the Hamiltonian for B is going to be minus 1 minus RS by R. There'll be some mass here. Plus half kb squared. Something which you might expect, but you have a free scalar field, a massless scalar field. It basically boils down to simple harmonic oscillator. Right. But the interesting thing is that the coupling to the wall is with this prefactor. Okay. So you have a collapsing wall. You have a yes. Right. And
so the scalar has nothing to do with the wall itself, right? It's just wall and separate.
Yes. Yes. So, K is the eigenvalue of N, basically. 1 by M is the eigenvalue of M, and this is the eigenvalue of N. So you've diagonalized it, and you get some quantity. No, no. Neither of them, they're both independent of R. That's important. Right, but you're going in this limit, B tends to zero, and when you do that, then I won't go into those details here, but you can check our paper. The important point is that the only interaction comes by this 1 over B. So the structure of the Hamiltonian is very natural, simple harmonic oscillator, and here is the interaction. Okay. So now you have this problem, and you want to, if in the semi-classical approach, you want to take R of t to be the solution, the classical solution. And then you want to solve H B psi is I d psi b by dt. Yeah? Okay. I might need your help bringing it down. No, not yet. But later. Okay. So how to solve that equation? Well, the first thing you do is define a time coordinate. Uh, then define a frequency, which depends on time, which is omega 0 squared by 1 minus rs by r. And omega 0 squared is defined to be k by m. Then that equation just becomes a simple harmonic oscillator with a frequency which depends on time. And you have to solve this problem, something which I'm sure we encounter all the time. The simple harmonic oscillator with a time-dependent potential. This is d by dB squared, dB squared. Okay? And this omega squared is. So the interesting thing is that this equation can be solved. The solution is, well, solved in quotation marks. Some phase factor, some normalization in terms of rho, which is a function actually of time. So this is, I actually didn't write down the reference, but you can see it. I think these people are condensed matter people who wrote down this solution in this way. The tricky part is this function rho, rho eta eta, which is second derivative of rho, satisfies this equation. And the initial conditions are that rho 0 is equal to 1 by square root of omega at 0, and rho eta 0 is 0. And this phase is known, it's in terms of rho, it's minus half integral 0 to eta d eta prime rho squared eta. Okay? So in other words, you have a solution for that equation. So it tells you the wave function for this mode coefficient b. Okay. So of course, the idea is that you would start it in its ground state, and then as time went on, it would get excited, and you would get certain occupation numbers. Okay? And you look at the occupation numbers, and you can tell how many particles were produced. So that's the next step. If you have the solution, then you have the occupation numbers. It's the scalar field wave function. Yeah. In a classical background. So what you do is you take the wave function, you expand it in certain basis states, and these are simple harmonic oscillator basis states. This tells you how much the particular mode is excited. And from here, you can calculate the occupation number at time t of a certain frequency omega bar, and this is just sum over n, n c n squared. And you have a nice expression for this. It's omega bar rho squared by root 2, 1 minus 1 over omega bar rho squared whole squared plus rho eta omega bar rho whole squared. Okay, so you can tell exactly how many particles are in the state at any given time or any given frequency. So the only problem here is that you don't know rho as a function of eta. This
only one IP. And you have to specify what IP amount it is, or
you can do it for any IP.
For any IP amount behaves like this.
So the only thing you have to do numerically is to solve this equation.
So we're describing the wave function for the field external to the domain wall or internal?
Remember
those functions?
Okay, so the field was defined. So imagine you have a field.
Yeah.
And you expand it in Fourier form.
Sure. But so the functions you define.
So these are, this is, the wave function is for these modes.
No, sure, I can't call that, but the function f of r, is that defined over all r?
Over all.
You have to, I mean, it's a bit awkward to do that, right? Because you have to do something different for 0 to rs.
I never needed the explicit form for those functions. And in fact, later when I did the principal axis transformation, it all gets mixed up anyway. So this is all implicit, what the FK can be. But what I do know is that this mode has a certain frequency of beta, and its amplitude is changing in this way, so I can calculate the occupation.
Sorry, so what? So those phi n's are what again? The basis states, so they're given by...
Phi
n in that equation, the SHO basis states.
And middle part.
The middle blackboard, right there. Right there.
This one.
Further over to the right.
Oh, the phi n.
Those guys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I have to define particle production. So I say initially there are no particles. Right? So I start with no particles, and so I choose...
But what's the relation of both phi m's to the solution before?
No, these are basis states. So...
Is that
kind of
like pronomial?
Sorry? You're expanding that solution in terms of that basis.
Right.
All right, and those coefficients can be calculated from that solution, and you get that answer for the square.
Okay, so...
What's
that
The little m? This was, and then you diagonalize m and n, then you get to k. Okay, so now we can find this numerically. We can solve for rho, and okay. So then I can just plot the n, which is a function of p and omega, as a function of t plus s, and I get this curve. And this curve is b, of course, that beats the t by rs, provided I fix omega bar rs. And this, there's a little, you have to choose the frequency. There are several frequencies involved. For example, you have omega squared, you have omega zero squared. And also remember that omega squared is the frequency in this time, eta, but eta is not t. So you have to be very careful in keeping track of the frequency. So so n grows like this. And you can also work out the spectrum. That is n as a function of omega. So if you work out n as a function of omega, actually, I'm using omega bar, but I probably didn't define it. So omega bar, this omega bar, omega bar is omega 0 e to the t by 2rs. So here, so if this is the final time at which you look, I should probably step back a little. So in here, I have to put a certain r function r of t. Okay. So what do I do? I take a constant r of t, then the r of t follows the classical equation, and then I stop it again. I can take any function r of t. So this is what I call the final time. And omega depends on r, see omega squared has the 1 by r in it, over here. And so omega keeps changing. So I have to be very careful to keep track of what omega I'm looking at. And so this is the final omega once you're up here.
So
when you have no more particle protection.
But doesn't this thing collapse within its Schwarzschild radius? Like you have r collapsing and then it halts.
So the function we took for r is the classical solution, which is something like r0 plus r0 is rs plus initial r0 minus rs equal to minus t. So that's the classical solution.
So you're assuming it, all right, so it goes to RS, that it asymptotically approaches the Schwarzschild radius in that time port.
I still don't understand why the tension of the brain doesn't enter anywhere. I mean, shouldn't it enter in the classical solution of the tension? No?
Because it's independent of the mass.
The evolution of R depends on the stress energy you put on the shell. It has to. It has to. Because you can put in different stress energies and you get different answers.
No, it's also going to change the structural radius.
It just sets the structural radius.
If you have pressure on the, you can put pressure in the shell, and that will change the other.
No, but here, this is the domain wall solution, so the pressure is all fixed. The solution just turns out to be this. I put this solution, and so I can look at the spectrum after any given time, and what I find is that at early times it does this. As time goes on, it does this. Okay.
So in that time, it never reaches the structural radius.
But you cut it off before it reaches it, right? I mean, if you've got that profile, really that classical curve should just decay exponentially.
Yes. Yes.
So you've actually chopped it off.
Yes, I've stopped it here, and I'm checking how many particles there are. I can move this PF as far along as I wish. That will get difficult. So there's no black hole, if that's your question. There's no black hole, this thing is collapsing, and it's emitting radiation.
But I thought that I had the Schwarzschild radius to start with, no?
No, it's outside of the Schwarzschild.
It's outside the Schwarzschild radius. It's collapsing political. Seems to grow. The linear part. Yeah. And you can try fitting the thermal distribution in this. If you do that, and you plot the log of 1 plus 1 over n, which is versus omega bar, there should be a line, and the thermal distribution would be this. This does something like this. Okay. However, the temperature you get from this fit seems to be something like 2.4 of the Hawking temperature. Hawking temperature is 1.45.
wait a minute, these aren't eigenmodes in the flat, in infinity, these are eigenmodes at, in terms of this eta time. So these are, so that's Hawking temperature at infinity, that's the temperature. But you have diagonalized in terms of this other time variable, which is at the...
So then you convert to the asymptotic, the t, little t, and that's...
But these aren't eigenmodes anymore.
But what happens to this thing is TF? Really, you should take TF to infinity, right?
Yes.
Because you can't stop collapse. So yes. What happens to these curves is TF?
So the point is that it's not the... So, okay. It's not quite legitimate to take it to infinity, because if you look at a certain time interval during collapse, you find a certain finite amount of energy. You keep waiting, that energy grows. The total energy diverges in the limit that t goes to infinity.
Well, but, I mean, it's got to collapse. You can't stop it. Right? I don't see why it's not. I mean, that may be a terrible thing to happen, but it might suggest there's something not accounted for in the problem. I mean, you can't just tell it it's going to gravitationally collapse and then all of a sudden say, no, now you stop. You need a force to stop it.
No. It's not a question of forces. It's the usual calculation that if something is collapsing, let's go back to the case where you have a plus charge and a plus charge and then colliding. And you said that as they're coming together, they're emitting photons. And if the energy losses are great enough, then they will never come within the motion radius.
Well, except that this is a shell collapsing. There are no repulsive forces, unlike that case.
No. The repulsive forces are inconsequential, even if you have minor.
Well, okay, but
it's still wrong. They're accelerating.
You do take general relativity into Oppenheimer's slight collapse of dust. You have to get the vapor pressure.
It's the same with the shell.
And the electric collapses to our zero.
This is a quantum. This is a quantum calculation in the background of the collapsing shell.
Yeah, but he's
so it shouldn't surprise you at all that there's radiation during for a time-dependent metric. You have a time-dependent metric, it radiates.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. But what I want to know is, what should be relevant is what happens in the limit of late t, because that's when you're asymptotically formed the horizon. And I don't see how you can justify that process being cut off. That's what I don't see.
What I'm saying is that the energy losses are so great.
The energy loss of what?
The energy losses from the collapsing shell. It's the radiating. It has to get to this Schwarzschild radius. But the Schwarzschild radius itself will shrink because of the energy losses. And it never catches up.
Oh. But then you need to make RS a function of time, which you haven't
yes,
done.
Yes, which we haven't done. So I agree. But what I'm saying here is that as the thing is collapsing, so this is a semi-classical case, and I'm going to move on to the non-semi-classical case.
But it would still seem to me you could have a gigantic, ultra-heavy shell where those energy losses ought to be negligible relative to the total mass of the shell. And then it still seems to me there should be some regime in which you've got to take TF to be gigantic. And then I would wonder what happens to those wiggles in that limit. I don't know why that's not a valid limit to look at. That's what
it's a perfectly good thing to do, but if you accumulate all the energy, your energy also starts blowing up as TF goes to infinity. That's what I'm saying, is that energy will diverge as TF goes to infinity. So let me...
If you take Oppenheimer's story of dust collapse, you have to get an event horizon. Everything collapses to a rate of zero, but the density, uniform density, is infinite. So once you follow your event horizon, you have to know your theorem.
Yeah, but that's assuming that the shell does not radiate any energy. He's saying here it does. And so some of that process, he claims, will always cut off the... D. theory saying you're going to have it, but he hasn't really put it in yet, which I guess you're going to do, right?
But this is a...
you're going to do now, right?
So I'm going to try and describe some work on taking the back direction to the trunk.
This is...
Yeah.
And how the problem changes.
This contradicts the no-hair theorem proof.
Sorry?
What you're doing is contradicting the no-hair theorem proof. That you have the black hole, once it collapses in front of the vapor mass, there's no hair. You can see the
black hole, there's no hair.
Yeah, but no, I agree with you. I don't see any hair in the black hole.
But because the quantum mechanics involved here, I suppose that, and be that quantum mechanics, there wouldn't be a problem. There would be no entering, but that's the classical theory.
See, the idea is, as this thing is collapsing, it's radiating particles, and the amount of particles it radiates according to that curve is diverging, and the only place those particles can get energy from is the shell, so the shell loses all its energy and never forms a black hole. I think that's the basic idea.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. Okay. I mean,
but you model that.
I'm not surprised.
You model that by artificially cutting off the shell. Right? You put in that cutoff to model that. But
yeah.
You stop the collapse. If you stop the collapse, then you can get this.
No, so
you stop the collapse, you don't get it.
So what this you're saying is that you look after 1 second, you find 10 particles, you look after 20 seconds, you see 100 particles, you look after 30 seconds, you get 5,000, 5 million particles, and eventually you've got so many particles that there's no energy left.
You're just calculating the activation number as a function of time.
Right. But let me go on. I'm not surprised that you're surprised, and I'm not, I mean, I should say that we struggled with this problem for quite a while. And this is the only logical...
And the cutoff will be roughly when the energy of the particles equals the total original energy shell. And that will turn into
Yeah, ultimately, that's right. This is an
RS. You really need RS to be time dependent to do it right, which is what he says he's going to do.
But the other thing I should say is that at least in the semi-classical case, we are able to find psi as a function of t all the way to t goes to infinity. So there is this question of whether unitarity will break down and unitary evolution will not happen. I don't see any evidence of that in this semi-classical case. But maybe
you said that the whole point is the n going to infinity, right? If we don't do this cutoff, we just keep going with that. So t is infinity, the black hole forms.
And then t is infinity, all the energy comes from the radiation.
Right, so n goes to infinity.
Yep.
So that, in some sense, that means you haven't, maybe you haven't a well-defined state in that limit, and that's the sense in which...
Well, RS is going to zero, like
we decided. No, I'm saying, before we think about back reaction, just let's suppose you've got an internal black hole which doesn't radiate, and just think about the scalar on that, and you send t to infinity, so then the black hole actually forms its RS. And then you said that the occupation number goes to infinity. Right, so that's normally what you get when you try and, if you calculate, if it's actually a mixed state that's forming rather than a pure state, then you might see that in the sense that your pure state has infinite occupation number. So it's not, it isn't obvious to me that that contradicts the normal statement that what you have external to the black hole is a thermal state.
The other thing is that the n is not really a covariant number, so the number of, depending on the frame that you look at, the number of particles. So basically the number of particles in Kerber spacetime is not an invariant quantity. So in the following coordinate you may have infinite number of particles, but in the other coordinate in infinity, you may have a finite number of particles. So that's the other thing. Because n is not an invariant number, basically, depending on the coordinates.
But it does mean that you usually have a non-unitary transformation between those two bases.
That's probably the case,
which is exactly what you get when, when the black hole forms,
then the coordinates that cover external to the back hole, the attraction coordinates, in other words, because they don't cover the whole space time, you have the Hartle-Hodel vacuum is mixed in those coordinates, whereas pure is pure in the purple.
Let me go on, otherwise we'll never... I don't want to...
You'll never reach a black hole.
Okay, so let's try and go beyond the set plus.
Yeah, here you never reach the end of the seminar. This is
that's a hot off TF.
Exactly. It's an example.
But we'll keep taking TF larger and larger.
Okay, so there's a first level in which you can go beyond the classical, which is that you let your wave function be the function of R and T. And you simply take your Hamiltonian to be the wall plus working for T for 4B. So then you can find this. There are certain issues that come up because remember frequency omega squared is omega u squared 1 times rs by r. But now r itself is part of this wave function. So the frequency is not well defined. I mean, you have to find the expectation of the frequency. So things get a little complicated. But so we find that the results we obtain roughly hold up with a few modifications. For example, we find that non-polarity actually seem to be larger in this case than the half a subcluster. But there is a sort of a higher level which of going beyond semi-classical. And that's what I want to describe now, because I've been struggling with it for about a year, and I had to put out a paper. And there are some issues that seem very interesting to me, and so I want to describe those. Okay, so this is, we're trying to include back reaction. So if you look at the classical Hamiltonian for the wall, it is minus d pi, and that is 1 minus 2g by r. And here, this is the Schwarzschild radius, so that should be the energy in the wall itself. So if I bring h wall to one side, I get 1 minus 2g pi by r inverse. And then that factor b I can think of as 1 pi by minus 2g pi by r. So now you can see the trouble when you quantize, the momentum is coming in the denominator. So the question is, can we handle that? So let me first write down the full quantum Hamiltonian. And now these are operators. And I restrict to just one mode for the scalar field. Okay. And now you say, well, what does this operator be? It turns out that by solving the differential equation, you can actually write B as an integral operator. So B acting on some function with minus I by 2G alpha inverse of R integral R dr prime. So you're shorting the, and I'm sorry, so this this alpha is this function e to the minus I r squared by 4g minus 4. So B is an integral operator. Your Schrodinger equation is an integral differential Schrodinger equation. And the question is, what do you do with it? So before I tell you what I think you can do with it, let me first describe what we might mean by a black hole. So we are interested in, for example, as an initial condition, we have to start with a black hole free state. So we have to define some concept of black holeness. So you might take this operator B, which is 1 minus G pi R H wall minus. I have to symmetrize these because of the commuticity. And you can say that if B psi is lambda psi, if you have an eigenstate of B, then lambda greater than 0 implies black free. So in the incipient limit, B becomes B, and then you can find the eigenstates. So these are the eigenstates, and if beta is positive, then you have the black hole piece. So in this language, supposing you start with a black hole free state, that means your initial wave function is a superposition of C only with beta positive. Then the question is, will time evolution lead you into eigenstates having overlap with eigenstates of beta negative? And actually, I was talking to some people at lunch, that it requires sort of going through beta equal to 0. I mean, if you think that it requires beta equal to 0, then the beta equal to 0 thing is crazy because it's oscillating infinitely rapidly. It's e to the minus I infinity r squared. Okay, but if you define black hole this way, then there is an immediate consequence, which is that if you work out the commutator of B and H, which means that you can't have simultaneous eigenstates of H and B, so you don't have objects which are definitely black holes having certain energy. So this is what I call energy black holeness.
What's the difference between the two B's again?
So this is with the, when I put the H wall in it, and strictly speaking, H wall is, so here I'm taking the H wall, right? And I'm saying is that in the incipient limit, so this is only in the incipient limit. If I put B phi here, then basically I would take this. So this is only in a limit. But at this, I was trying to be more general.
Is that 1 minus GHW over R minus GHW? Oh, you've written them in different orders. That's why.
Mm-hmm.
I see.
Okay. All right. So now I want to describe gravitational collapse. Using this integral differential equation. But it turns out that I can operate by B inverse. and convert it into a differential equation, of course, then you get higher derivatives. But the resulting equation I find quite I thought I should give that. So there's a 1 minus 2g by r, I dt minus dt squared by 2, I. And this is equal to I dt minus 2 to the dt squared plus kt squared. So here is what I call the quantum gravitational collapse equation. I shouldn't, I've put it out, and I'm hoping to hear from others whether it makes sense or does make sense. So maybe let me just say what I like about it and what disturbs me. So on the right hand side, I dt is like the energy. Okay. So this is energy minus the energy in the simple harmonic oscillator. So if you wish. So the right hand side is something like energy minus the energy in the beat. And the left-hand side, there's an R, supposing this was not there, then this would just be some sort of time dependence, but this R is being the time derivative. Now we know that, at least in quantum cosmology, there is no time variable. One of the parameters, one of the variables, plays the role of time. In this case, R plays the role of time. So that's just the left, the right side of the usual Schrodinger equation, I d by dt psi. And this is the gravitational interaction. 1 minus 2g by r. And then this is the energy minus kt squared. So this is something like left hand side is almost like 1 plus 2g by r. 1 minus energy. Minus dt squared by 2. So in particular, you can write down solutions of this, in which all the energy is in the B. Okay? So that would just be the right hand side is 0, the left hand side is 0. And if you don't put all the energy in B, then of course there is some evolution. And the question is, does the energy get transferred from R into B? So I don't have a solution for this. It's a little nasty because we have BT and DR being mixed, as well as you might have similarity. What puzzles me is that there is, I would normally have thought that this should be the mass in the wall, which would mean that I should have a pi squared by 2 and the kinetic term also over here. But that doesn't come up, I think, because the way the interactions are structured, the wall interacts with the kinetic part of the number 1 over b gets the pi squared by 2m, but nothing comes up with the picture. Anyway, so I think I can understand the structure, but you'll have to wait and see. So anyway, to conclude, so we discussed the semi-classical analysis. And here, my interpretation was that collapsing object evaporates by non-thermal pre-Hawking radiation, not quite Hawking, So it's like hopping and building up stage. If you go to beyond semi-classical, this basically stays. And with back reaction, we have an equation, but I don't know what the solution is. Okay, thank you.
Everybody raises their hand.
We'll just go from left to right. It's very interesting to put together so this piece of to something in the S that we know about the cause is just connected with the thing you were saying before. So so when I'm close to the horizon, there's nothing special in a place.
So terminationally, there is certainly nothing special. But the question whether the field theory there's something special
for field theory. Because but I mean, my point is, in order for the field theory to feel something special, it has to be connected the horizon with the infinity, because it's only at infinity that you can define a vacuum, and that you can know that something is happening there to the horizon, and I see it as a radiation here at infinity, let's say. So it looks like a very non-local process, and I don't understand how this. But another process can be so fast to make the shell collapse even before the black hole is formed. So, like a typical friendship should be the ones evoking radiation, which can be very very big. And if I'm following my shell, I would risk the singularity very fast. And I don't explain how. In my local,
you would see similarities. You would see things happening fast, and you would also see things happening at infinity. Or you would at least calculate them pretty fast.
Yeah, but they have no time to go to infinity. That's my point. I mean, they have no time. I'm already dead.
Sorry. Let me just drop my response. So yes, that is the same thing of the informal observer, seeing everything happening. However, the informal observer is not just enough to say it's happening at 1 second. The clock people speed up your clock and say, well, things are happening much faster. So if I do the calculation and I find observation numbers sort of with respect to the time of the infalling person, then I get similar answer. But it doesn't explain what the infalling observer will see. I think that's where the confusion is coming up, because the particles are only defined at infinity, and close by you don't know what's happening. So I agree there's a question there that can be said. We were thinking of using the asymptotic observer for most physics.
I think my question is pretty closely related, actually, which is that so what we see here is in the calculation that you've done, somebody sitting in infinity watching the shell drop, yes. Sees it radiating energy very rapidly, and if he waits forever, basically what happens is he will see as much energy come out as there was in the shell to begin with. So it's not going to actually diverge, it's just, you know, as much energy goes out as you put into the system.
Right.
And so at that point he says the thing is evaporated and there's no more left.
Yeah.
Now,
no more collapsing shell.
No more collapsing
shell.
Now, in sort of a standard case of Hawking radiation where I actually form a black hole, where I don't do the calculation this way, where I just say I form the black hole and then I calculate its lifetime due to Hawking radiation, an observer at infinity will see essentially the same thing. He will sit there and he will see the thing radiate until as much energy comes out and went in. And so from that perspective, we say black hole Hawking evaporated. I know that, which gets to the meat of my question. So at some point, So, and I'm trying to say this without trying to follow the observer down, but at a certain point you have to say, okay, so what's creating the radiation in the collapsing shell? And essentially what you're saying is that in some sense the matter in the shell is coupling via gravitons to the scalar field, right? It's a purely gravitational coupling. So it's producing gravitons which are sourcing the phi field, which is carrying the energy off, right? But how can you, I mean, but all you've answered is the question is, what does the observer at infinity see sort of in an integrated sense? And so how do you know that once it gets really down to the point at which you're starting to form the black hole, that in fact you'll be strongly enough coupled by gravitational modes to actually reduce phi at the rate that you think? So it doesn't seem that this calculation really answers the question of which wins, gravitational collapse or particle production, in a completely unambiguous way.
Well, so
it depends on where you put your cutoffs.
No, right? I'm not sure I agree with that. I think first, let me just quickly say what the distinction is between the two scenarios that you put collapsing object and evaporating black hole gravity. One is that of course the astrological observer in one case, at least the calculation is done, shows some departures from normality, from Hawking temperature. Whereas in the black hole case you can see things at the Hawking temperature and normality.
Right. I agree that if you could actually really observe this.
So but maybe then let's see.
The basic question is, how do we know whether or not, once you really get into the regime where you're radiating rapidly, that the coupling is actually strong enough to radiate at that rate? So that it seems to me that the crucial point at which your entire conclusion rests is exactly at the point at which your calculation breaks down.
I'm not sure where you say that the calculation. I mean, there is a back reaction, but no one, there are very few papers on back reaction and physical problems, but within the semi-classical picture, I don't see a breakdown.
Well, the semi-classical picture is going to break down as soon as the energy radiated gets to be comparable to the original
But that in itself is interesting. Because if you say that solar mass orbit is collapsing, then you would expect that you get a black hole of a solar mass. But here you're saying, the energy radiation is comparable to a solar mass.
You've taken a very particular kind of shell that gives you that kind of evolution, and you might have, I mean, the question is, can you get some other shell with a different evolution where you can always be confident that the shell will fall within its radius before it's radiated off all these scalar fields? Then it would answer your question positively.
I would be really surprised if you can change the shell or the nature of the shell and get a different answer. Because at the end, the Hamiltonian that you're taking is just a relativistic particle, which is collapsing. And it has a sort of universal B factor in front of it. So I would be really surprised if by changing the nature of the shell,
let me rephrase my earlier statement. Standard fiction, as I have learned, is that if you have a collapsing star consisting of matter and pressure, then you have the Hawking-Penrose theorem state that if the weak and strong energy conditions are satisfied, then the geodesic vector focus, and you must have a similarity of the center, and you get them within the class. So, I know this is a classical statement, but nonetheless, you must have violated something about the Hawking-Penrose theorems in order to get a completely non-singular solution. So I'll venture that if your energy conditions are violated.
They must be.
They have to be.
And
if I can construct solutions which are non-singular and totally non-singular in collapse, and you do violate one of the energy conditions, then you do not get a black hole.
But there's no cracked surface. So it doesn't violate the theorem. You've got conditions where you've got stuff collapsing, but the stuff collapsing is coupled to something that radiates the energy away, so it gets weaker and weaker and dissolves before it gets to collapse. Will's question is this always going to happen or not? And I'm not, I mean, you've worked on this and I haven't, but I actually would not be surprised if there was some configuration of stress energy that could beat out quantum radiation.
No, but if you think about it,
it seems very
reasonable that this collapsing object is close to the Schwarzschild radius. The radiation is roughly the opposite.
Yeah, if it's a super gigantic black hole, that's very cold temperature.
Yeah, that's a very cold temperature.
So why would it radiate all the stuff for it?
But the, at least the classical trajectory that you're putting in, and this is all set classical. This is something like R of t is going like e to the minus t by RS. So you just keep waiting for it to get to the Schwarzschild radius, and it keeps evaporating. Even if it's tiny, you integrate it over t goes to infinity. And you get all the energy out before you get to RS.
But you have to violate the definition.
That's true even with standard Hawking radiation. An observer at infinity would see the Schwarzschild never have the Schwarzschild radius, but you would see all the energy come out, and you would see exactly the same thing. Maybe you'd see a different spectrum. But that's kind of my point, is that even if you don't do this, even if you just consider standard Hawking radiation, you would conclude by that sort of an argument that the black hole never formed either. Right, because it takes an infinite amount of time from the point of view of the observer at infinity for the matter to reach the event horizon, and even if it's only Hawking radiated. But it takes a finite amount of time for it to radiate away.
No, but in
So the Hawking space time diagram, I looked at it a little more carefully, and it has some strict features. I'm not sure if it's fine. Otherwise, maybe you can explain these features. Yeah, something like this. And this point is supposed to be mysterious. That is the end point of it. But now you do have observers that are going like this, and objects that are falling in. And what you're saying is that all the energy, so as this says, supposing something is collapsing, and it keeps emitting, and all the energy is received in this region. And then after a little while, this person who's here sees things disappear. So what have they disappeared into? Because all the energy has been radiated here.
But from a practical perspective, I mean, all you're doing is altering that diagram so that the horizon size is getting smaller with time as well, right? Faster. So that, I mean, you would still see from the point of view of someone sitting outside, if you had a really, really massive, you know, gravitationally collapsing object, it would still, for all practical purposes, look to the guy on the outside like a black hole. Right?
Well, you wouldn't have
you would see corner. Things fall into this, but it would just be falling in behind this collapsing shell, and it would take a long time, and it would radiate away, and it would redshift, and maybe it would go dark, and all that kind of stuff. So from phenomenologically, it would still look like an astrophysical
object.
You're making an argument about
synthesis. Yeah, for astrophysically, it would look simple, yeah.
Right.
But that could just be time scaling. I mean, I know that Sunny also has a stringy picture where photons come in and spend a lot of time inside and then come out. So it's just a question of time scaling. But in this case, there's no singularity, no black hole, it's all a stringy fuzz.
You have to just stay on the proper side of the coordinate time.
Sorry?
You have to just stay on the proper side of the coordinate time. The star collapses in finite proper time very rapidly. And coordinate time, it takes an infinite amount of time to see the event rise and fall. So, the point about the proper time is that you're working out Oppenheimer's dilemma. It happens exponentially fast, like that. Coordinate of t, you never see the event horizon fall. So I don't understand how you get around this.
Well, the plane is that all the energy radiates away before the thing ever forms, and that's the plane I'm trying to get. That's a very strong statement.
You can view it at you can view it at second. You ask, did my Schrodinger equation break down at some point? So I don't have any data. No, and you can follow it all the way. Do you ever get thermal radiations of this object? You don't.
Well, in the case of production of passive particles in quantum field theory, from the vacuum to Schrodinger calculated this, you need very strong electric fields to get infinite production. In fact, infinitely strong.
No,
so here, something has to break down.
This is in time. So as when you integrate it in time, the cumulative particle increases. And you get everything back out that you put in some finite long time.
Well, if you do a Schrodinger calculation for pair production, you would find there's an obstruction for getting all the energy out from pair production. I know you can cut off the electric fields.
It's very intriguing. What troubles me about it is just that it's tantamount to the claim that saying a black hole will never form because any configuration of matter that gravitationally collapses will quantum radiate away its energy before it can form a horizon. That's a very strong statement. True for all possible initial data. That's why I find it, I know you say the other way around, but I find that very hard to swallow.
Otherwise, can you always prevent the black hole from
the statement is tantamount.
This is always the bottom line.
Maybe we should cut off. Yeah. We can come out later this afternoon and tomorrow. So good tomorrow. So we can continue arguing.
See how much interest this stimulates.
Sorry?
See how much interest this has stimulated. Otherwise we wouldn't be yelling at words.
Oh, there you got lots of paper outside. You should be able to do the same problem.
It's just
it's pure ETS outside as well as it.
Yeah, you can
definitely see that as well. That is the key.
We have direct in the harmonic oscillator, but I think that's all. I mean, it could be said that as you fall in it, you could say, I'm flying inside the universe.
Also, you can see what the outside universe
falls out.
Yes,
So,
we assume
accelerated.
So that the mass size is
there. Is drop set.
No. So if you have a massive scale,
then there is.
Then you saw when you're in school, then you answer the front scale.
There is some explicit light.
So this work of the scattering shape. When you consider the part, then what happens?
You know, they will generalize like dynamic horizon.
Yes, but they will try and act as
fear.
That's right.
Specifically, cause problems and people say,
then you don't have a scale.
You never really have an event horizon. Like, what
is the problem?
It's very
complex. That's on the bed, you don't have a scale
already.
But you do have a dynamic
horizon. With vector, I think
you have some side effects.
You'd have to go beyond
so you could ask
The other thing is this number of particles, which is, I think it's just very frame dependent and going every space time. So you have this particular frame, a maximum maturity of the physical frame. You come up with a differential equation. I think there is something in it which has a differential number of particles, but it's not the same number of particles and observable physics.
And a trap surface.
So the big question is there a trap surface?
Yeah.
If there's a trap surface, then you have to find something there.
Or by the power of
the which is in the.
The light scale is always working in the brain.
The question is,
the
whole thing of this is
the brain in which part not that something merges in the same brain.
When is there scale
there? So there's not some other official frame.
So your time of eta is like,
so you have the easy answer is just to say, you go
all the way,
it's
not the physical, it's something I think that I'm saying.
But I think I've heard people argue.
And there is no reason that the number of particles in terms of that time, because number of particles just the Fourier
problem is already kicked in.
If you have a solution, the Fourier transform
some
time, the basic frequency spectrum is the number of particles, but you have different
it's
time.
Not enough just to say
the number of particles in terms of
just 200 kilos of modeling on the good first of like, And the question is, can this thing have all that information?
Yes, but okay.
Could the whole
set? That's the final.
So I think people argue
the equation and then
you have to start seeing on the correlation.
There's a quantity
that we can use.
If you go to a different time, of course,
sort of the information
then the frequency is different, and I'm quite sure that you get a different.
And then you can add up all the information that supposedly went into the body.
The way in which collapses is created, even if having quality where he says it's a relationship.
But I think it's more than that, because I mean, you have no particle in one.
I'm not as worried about that. I'm more worried about the generality of the state.
If I take a couple of
that's like CTZ.
Or some sort of like, I mean, you could imagine a really big dust cloud.
But you'll certainly get something that will look like.
I think in this scenario, suppose I got some ultra super heavy object, a shell, that if it moved like a centimeter, you're going to form a black hole. It's very hard to believe it's going to radiate scalars fast enough. Maybe it does, but it's hard to believe I can't adjust the parameters of the initial data to beat out what you get. Maybe I'm wrong, but it's just, isn't that surprising?
But what happens if you have a weak electric field, but for a very long time?
Yeah.
So that would be an infinite number of particles.
Anyway, if I can send you this collapse paper I did recently, but it'd be nice to see what would happen.
Any alternate viewpoint simple.
If you don't wait a long time, you would get a black hole.
I was wondering, if you calculate, so rather than the number of particles, if you calculate the energy, I think that's something that's more relevant.
So we're calculating the temperature,
the temperature is for the number of the spectrum. Yes, but instead of the spectrum,
the frequency of the number is
infinity. So that's frequency at infinity, right? Okay. And the fact that this is just, so this is like linear increasing with time, or is it like?
So there I wasn't really clear, but I'm certainly getting, but you've got n, so n is a function of t.
This is the frequency of infinity, right?
So omega, so that's the point. What do you hold fixed when you've got n as a function of t?
Yeah.
And if you hold omega bar,
I'd like t at infinity and omega at infinity, right? All of them.
Then we would be left with constant
number of particles. It doesn't increase the time. Because talking radiation when it is not a problem, right?
So I think whatever it is, it's consistent with the fact that this thing is
Ah, it is consistent. But you said it's two times Hawking or something.
Yeah.
Okay, it's something different.
But the temperature itself is not growing.
So you know, there is a paper by Padmanabhan, I'm not sure if it's saying it, it's just a very short paper. It's a classical paper, looks at a source that's emitting at some frequency to fall into the black hole. And then what he does is look at the redshift effect, basically, and redshift effect is a function of quantum system knowledge. And what he shows is that when you Fourier transform, no matter what it's emitting in its redshift frame, the Fourier transform that infinity looks like Hawking with the right temperature. So that's why, that's why I'm a bit skeptical about this number of particle business, because that could change from frame to frame. But the energy shouldn't, in principle, but I guess you're saying the transformation from one to the other is straightforward. So anyway, so this is a very nice paper, I think it's about 10 years old. And it's completely classical. And you get the spectral dependence, you don't get the amplitude, but you get the spectral dependence. Which at least the claim of the paper, I don't think I followed everything exactly. It's just you get the quantum spectrum. Very aggressive.
So I came to stop Vancouver and Bill Andrew.
It's far more precious than anyone.
But all of us combined, maybe could come
back. That's really interesting.
It was an interesting question. It's very hard to. The problem always is when you find out. I had constructed a solution where I have Einstein scalar here, trying to point. And so I don't have harmony in it for zero. And the engineer says it's going to feel on the right hand side. So I constructed a non scalar solution, a metric, a static, slightly symmetric solution. Came along, she was a bloke, sitting on zero in my windows, and I followed it through, and I calculated the total mass, and it's positive, because the solution becomes the suction of my summer, and it's finally gone. Then I calculated a row, big G, 0, 0, and it's positive, and then it goes negative, the whole suction radius, and back up to zero. So I violate Europa CP, which told